Appreciate everyone being here today. And again, I want to welcome all of you who may be online watching us. Appreciate you joining us today. I have preached at a lot of funerals. I have attended a lot of funerals. I've sang at funerals. I've done all kinds of things with that. And one of the songs that comes up a lot in funerals is the song, "Does Jesus Care?" And each verse begins with a question. Does Jesus care when my heart is pained too deeply for mirth or song? The second verse says, does Jesus care when my way is dark with a nameless dread and fear? Another verse says, does Jesus care when I've said goodbye to the dearest on earth to me? And the chorus comes back after each of these verses and says, in the strongest possible way, oh yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. And I think it's worth asking the question, how do we know that Jesus cares? And we might be tempted to say, well, he's Jesus, that's why. But actually the scripture gives us, I think, some more concrete reasons, and I want us to think about that today. You know, if it is true that Jesus reigns now in heaven, if it's true that he sits in heaven with all power, surrounded by angels, surrounded by perfect holiness, he's not here on earth with us, how do we know that he cares? And the answer is, he's not always been in heaven. He has been here on earth. And he has been in our situation. And he knows what it is like to experience temptation, to experience heartache, to experience disappointment. He knows what that is like. And the text I want us to look at today that talks about that comes from Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. And I want to start reading in verse 14, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then draw with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. I want us to ask the question, does Jesus care? And the answer is, of course he cares. And this text, I think as well as any in the New Testament, provides us with the reason why Jesus cares for us. The reason why Jesus cares so deeply is because he has experienced the kinds of things that we have and that has made him sympathetic with us in his role as our high priest. Chapter 4, verse 14 starts a new line of argumentation in the book of Hebrews. As we said before, the book of Hebrews just goes through with one argument after another that Jesus is greater than really anything that the law of Moses could give. And in the first few chapters, he's established that Jesus is greater than the angels. That's chapters 1 and 2. Chapters 3 and 4, he is greater than Moses, he is greater than Joshua. And in this section, he's going to talk now in an indirect way about Jesus' superiority over Aaron and the entire Aaronic priesthood that we read about in the Old Testament. Now, this is not the first time that we have been introduced to Jesus as our high priest. He's been talked about in that way in several places. It's interesting, you go back to chapter 1, in verse 3, we're told that he made purifications for sin, which refers to his actions or his role as our high priest. And we're also told in chapter 2, verse 17, therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. And again in chapter 3, verse 1, therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him, who appointed him, just as Moses was also faithful in all of God's house. Now, to an astute Jewish reader, I'm sure at this point they've got some questions. Well, in what sense is he the high priest. Now, they might be able to understand, okay, he made purification for sins by offering himself as a sacrifice. Maybe they're thinking purely in terms of the sacrifice. But two times prior to chapter 4, verse 14, we have this reference to Jesus as some kind of a high priest. But again, if you were an astute Jewish reader and if you knew the story of Jesus, you knew that Jesus did not come from the tribe of Levi. Jesus came from the tribe of Judah. So in what way could he be a high priest? And that's really what this middle section of the book, chapter 4, the end of chapter 4 through the end of chapter 7, directly addresses. In what way is Jesus a high priest? He obviously is a different kind of high priest from Aaron, so is it a legitimate kind of high priesthood? How does this work? And that's really what he's trying to address. But he begins with an exhortation, and that's what we just read in chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. He begins with an exhortation to draw near to Jesus, who is our high priest, and he explains why we need to do that. In chapter 5, in the first 10 verses, he will talk about Jesus' qualifications as a high priest. And then he has this exhortation in the middle of all of this, the second half of chapter 5, and all of chapter 6, he hits the pause button in the argument and says, now, I'd like to talk more about this priesthood of Jesus, but I need to talk to you about your attitudes. I need to talk to you about your lack of maturity. I need to talk to you because you're really not up to speed yet. I'm not sure if you can handle this argument. And then in chapter 7, he goes back and makes this lengthy comparison between Jesus and a man from the Old Testament named Melchizedek. Now, as we continue through our study of Hebrews, we're going to talk about each one of these particular points. But I think it's interesting that he begins with an exhortation. He starts a new line of argumentation with an exhortation to come to Jesus the high priest and learn to draw near to him and approach this throne of grace. We need to have confidence in Jesus as our high priest. So even before he explains what it means that Jesus is the high priest, he's exhorting his readers to come to Jesus and draw near to him. So this is what the next section of argumentation looks like in the book, end of chapter 4 through the end of chapter 7. I want us to look now at chapter 4, verses 14 through 17. The whole point as he draws to the end of chapter 4 is we need to approach Jesus and we need to approach this throne of grace which Jesus has given us access to in our lives by what he has done. And so he starts in verse 14 by saying, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. He talks in the first part of verse 14 about the position of Jesus. He simply states it as a fact, since we have this great high priest. He's already affirmed twice, we saw back in chapter 2, verse 17, we saw in chapter 3, verse 1, that Jesus is, in fact, our high priest. And so since we have this high priest, and he doesn't just stop there, since we have this high priest who has passed through the heavens. Now, what does he mean by that? He doesn't say passed into the heavens, although that's clearly where Jesus is. If he made purification for sins and sat down at the right hand of the Father, which is what chapter 1 told us, he is in the heavenly places. But I suspect that when he talks about passing through the heavens, first of all, I think the heavens probably in this case is a reference to just the heavens above us, not necessarily the direct dwelling place of God. He has gone from this world to the next, I think, is the language that he's using here in verse 14. He has gone through the visible heavens to that invisible place. He has left this domain of humanity and he has gone to the domain of heaven itself. And it may also be kind of a backhanded reference to what the earthly priest, Aaron, and his fellow priests did in their service. Once a year, the high priest would pass through the veil into the most holy place. Once a year, he was allowed to do that. Jesus has done this in a permanent and eternal kind of way, which already indicates the superiority of his place, his position as our high priest. And so, since we have this great high priest, and since we have this high priest who has passed through the heavens, and then notice how he identifies him. He calls him what? Jesus, the Son of God. Now, he's been called Jesus, And he's been called the Son of God earlier in the text. But for the first time, these two things are brought side by side. And I think there's some significance to that. First of all, you go back to chapter 2, verse 9, he is called Jesus, but we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. I think it's significant that there his earthly name was used. Chapter 1 says he is greater than the angels, which means he's God. He was the creator. He brought these things into existence. He is the exact imprint of God's nature. That's chapter 1. But he became lower than the angels, which means he became human, and he had a human name and a human family and human trappings. So I think that's why in chapter 2, verse 9, he is referred to as Jesus. In chapter 3, he refers to him as Jesus in his comparison to Moses. He doesn't compare the Messiah to the lawgiver. He compares Jesus to Moses. But it also prepares us for something that we're told later when he compares Jesus to Joshua in chapter 4. Joshua is an Old Testament name that means salvation. Jesus is the Greek equivalent of it. So I think by using the word Jesus back in chapter 2 and chapter 3, he's preparing us for the reference to Joshua. Why does he use the word Jesus now? Because I think he's trying to emphasize Jesus' human sympathy with us, with mankind, with his readers here in the book of Hebrews. But he combines it with the phrase Son of God, which again is a term that has been used from the beginning. Chapter 1, verse 2, God has in former times God spoke to the fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. And in chapter 1, verse 5, for to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my Son, today I have begotten you? Chapter 1, verse 8, but of the Son of God he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And chapter 3, verse 6, but Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. So this opening affirmation is an affirmation about the position and identity of Jesus. He is our high priest, and not just a high priest, he is our great high priest. He has passed from this world to the next. He resides in the heavenly places, having passed through the heavens. And he is Jesus, the one who lived here on earth in human form, but he is also the Son of God. And so since we have this high priest, the application, and this is the second part of verse 14, here's exhortation number one, we need to hold fast. Hold fast to what? Now, that word hold fast means to grab hold of something. By the way, there's some phrases here in verse 14. He says, let us hold fast our confession. Something close to a dozen times in the book, he says, let us do this. Let us do that. And it's always in the form of an exhortation. He's trying to urge his readers, continue on in your faith. Don't give up what you're doing. Keep track with your faith in Christ. And so he says, let us, and then he says, hold fast. There's only two places where this word is used in the book of Hebrews. It's used actually quite a bit in the New Testament. It meant to seize something, to grab something, to take hold of something. Jesus once took hold of someone when he healed them. When Judas took the Roman soldiers into the garden to betray Jesus, he said, the one whom I kiss is the one that you will seize, and they seized Jesus. Same word, it means to grab something, to seize something, to hang on to it. But it also carries the connotation of commitment to something. For example, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verse 15, Paul said, so then, brothers, stand firm and hold to, that's this word, hold to the traditions that you were taught by us, either by our spoken word or by our letter. And the word is used several times in the book of Revelation, in the letters to the seven churches, for instance. Revelation chapter 2, verse 13, to the church in Pergamum. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name. And you did not deny my faith. In chapter 2, verse 25, in the church letter to the church in Thyatira, He exhorts them, only hold fast what you have until I come. And again, in Revelation chapter 3, in verse 11, Revelation 3, verse 11, the Lord said, I am coming, hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown. So this word is a word that denotes clinging to something firmly. Or it can mean to seize on something and not let go. He says here, you need to hold fast to what? Hold fast our confession. This word confession is another important word in the book of Hebrews. The word confession just means to confess something, to acknowledge something, to avow something, affirm that you believe something. Often it's used in the context of a statement of belief. It can also carry the connotation of a profession of one's faith. Here's what you say, and then your life reflects that as well. And here in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. And I think there it's in almost the form of what we would call a creedal confession. They had acknowledged that Jesus was their Lord. At some point, they made a verbal acknowledgement. He said, now, we need to hang on to that. If you have identified Jesus as the apostle and the high priest of your faith and confession, if you have acknowledged Jesus as Lord, you need to live that way now. In chapter 4, verse 14, which is our current text, the word occurs again. In chapter 10, verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. So time and again in the book of Hebrews, we're told to hold fast to something, and time and again this word confession comes up. And the exhortation here is you need to hang on to what you confessed at some point. And I think the confession here is probably when they became Christians. One of the things that we do when we baptize someone, we ask them if they believe that Jesus is what? Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Do they believe that? Why is it important to ask someone that? Because generally we tell people what we believe. If you don't believe that, why would you say it? We believe that our words reflect our commitment. Our words reflect our beliefs. And so he says, we need to hang on to that thing that we said when you became a Christian. Hold fast to your confession. Did you really believe that Jesus was Lord the day you became a Christian? Did you really believe that Jesus was the Christ the day that you became a Christian? Did you really believe that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God, when you obeyed the gospel, when you were baptized into Christ? Did you really believe that made a difference? And that's why this confession of faith is so important. That confession that Jesus is Lord ought to transform your life in every conceivable way. It ought to be transformative. And that's why when we waver in our faith, when we're living in uncertain times, when we're dealing with problems and we don't see a resolution to it, when we're dealing with situations and there seems to be no good outcome whatsoever, then more than any other time, we need to go back to our confession that Jesus is Lord. Do you really believe that or not? Do you really believe right now, in whatever circumstances you're in, whatever problems you're dealing with, whatever challenges you're facing, do you believe that Jesus is Lord? Do you believe that Jesus is the high priest of your confession? Do you believe that Jesus is the apostle of our faith? Do you really believe that? And have you let your life be shaped according to that reality? Far too often we treat that confession as something, well, it's just what you're supposed to say before you get baptized. No, that's the critical thing. And if we don't believe that, then our confession is emptiness and it's nothing more than a lie. Jesus is Lord, and we need to hang on to that with everything we've got, because that is what will change your life. That is what gives you hope in the midst of uncertainty. That is what grounds you solidly when everything else is shifting and moving and changing all around you. And so he says, look at who Jesus is. And because of that, you need to hang on to that reality. So that's the first exhortation in this little three-verse paragraph. Then he goes back to Jesus' position, or goes back to the idea of Jesus being high priest, but the emphasis now is a little bit different. In the first case, in the first part of verse 14, the emphasis was upon the position and the identity of Jesus. Now, he makes a statement about the same fact. Jesus is our high priest. So what? Now the emphasis is upon the fact that that gives him sympathy with us in a way that he could not otherwise have, in a way that would not otherwise be helpful to us. Jesus is our high priest, but that makes him able to sympathize with us. He states it in a negative way in verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize, which is another way of saying we have a high priest who does sympathize. I'm not sure why he uses the double negative here, but he's making that point. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. And I've wondered again why he states that in that particular way. I have a couple of theories. Number one, I think we read a lot about certain priests in the Old Testament who weren't very good priests. In fact, some of them were downright scoundrels. And maybe he wants his readers to think briefly about some of these priests who weren't very good priests. One of the best examples I can give you comes from the book of 1 Samuel, the sons of Eli. Do you remember how they were described over in 1 Samuel chapter 2? 1 Samuel chapter 2, we are told down in verse 12, now the sons of Eli were worthless men, they did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling, and with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. They were scoundrels. They were worthless. It's pretty bad when the scriptures say that somebody is worthless. And this is speaking of the high priest. They had no sympathy with the offerers. They didn't care what God's word said about how priests were to conduct themselves. And maybe the writer's point here in Hebrews 4 is we don't have that kind of priest. We don't have priests like Eli's sons who have no sympathy. And you can say the same thing about some of the priests in New Testament times. During the Roman era, you know, normally the priesthood was simply to be the descendants of Aaron through a certain lineage. By New Testament times, the priesthood became a political office appointed by Roman rulers. And we see some of the priests in the New Testament. They weren't exactly sympathetic to the Jews. It was a political office for many of them. And so whether you're thinking about some of the corrupt Old Testament priests or some of the corrupt New Testament priests, the writer here could say, we don't have that kind of priest. We have a priest who is sympathetic with us. To give you a modern analogy, have you ever heard about politicians who went to Washington and stayed there for years and years and years and lost touch with reality? Well, that seems to be a pretty common thing, doesn't it? They lose touch with the people that they're supposed to represent. And I think that's his point here. We have a high priest, and yes, he is in the heavenly places, but he hasn't forgotten about us because he remembers what it's like to be here. And so we have this high priest who is not unsympathetic. We go back to our text now in Hebrews 4, verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. That word sympathy means to feel for someone, to have compassion for someone, a willingness to act. And the word does not necessarily mean that you have to be in exactly the same circumstances in order to sympathize. A lot of times someone will say, well, you just don't know my situation. How can you possibly know what I'm going through? Sympathy does not require that your circumstances are identical. The same word is used in chapter 10. Same word is used in chapter 10, verse 34. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. When he says you had compassion, it's the same word. You had sympathy on those who were in jail. They were not in jail, but they knew people who were, and because of the mutual feeling they had for one another, they had sympathy. We have a high priest who has sympathy with us because there is a similarity of his circumstances, although his circumstances were not completely identical. Jesus' divine origin, Jesus was God. It did not prevent him from being sympathetic with us. Because he was God, he still had sympathy with us because, according to chapter 2, he became one of us. His deity did not interfere with his humanity, as it were. He was able to feel what we feel. And so he says here in our text, we do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Now that doesn't mean that Jesus experienced exactly the same temptation that every one of us has. His point is, Jesus experienced the same kinds of temptations that we do. Jesus, for example, was never tempted to hate his wife. He wasn't married. But Jesus experienced frustration with other humans. Jesus experienced disappointment with other humans. Jesus experienced people who hated him and tried to do bad things to him. Jesus experienced hunger. Jesus experienced grief. He experienced the same kinds of things that we do. Over in 1 John chapter 2, and I don't think this is necessarily a reference to that passage, but this is the kind of thing I think the Hebrews writer is kind of point that he's making. Hebrews chapter 2, down in verse 15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And I think when we study 1 John in that particular passage, I think we are spot on in saying that's really what temptation is all about. Sin manifests itself in a lot of different ways, but you can boil it down to one of these three things. The desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life. And I think there's a great correspondence between this and the temptation that Jesus experienced in the wilderness with Satan. The intense hunger. If you're so hungry, turn these stones into bread. The desires of the flesh. The desires of the eyes. He took him to this great place and showed him all the kingdoms of the world. Said, bow down to me and this can be yours. And also the appeal to pride. Cast yourself from this high place and see if God will catch you. It's the same kinds of temptations that we experience. Maybe not exactly the form. I've never been tempted to jump off a high place. But nonetheless, I believe Jesus and I have some things in common. I don't know all the forms of Jesus' temptation. By the way, you remember at the end of that temptation, Satan left him for a more opportune time. That wasn't the only time Jesus was tempted. Jesus was tempted every day of his life here on earth. And we need to understand that it's an opportunity to do wrong. It's a choice between right and wrong. And Jesus had those things. I don't know exactly all the ways that Jesus was tempted, but the writer of Hebrews makes the point that in whatever ways you and I are tempted, Jesus experienced the same kinds of things, even if the specifics were different. And that's why he is sympathetic with us. He knows what it's like to be tempted to depart from God. He faced that on a day-to-day basis. And what we need to remember, someone says, yeah, but Jesus never succumbed to the temptation. And you're absolutely right. The Hebrew writer's point is not that Jesus had sympathy with us in sin. He had sympathy with us in temptation. Keep that in mind, because that means since Jesus never sinned, he experienced temptation at a level that none of us ever have. If you know what it's like to suffer through temptation and not sin, in that regard, you know what it's like, what Jesus experienced. If you have ever suffered with temptation and you fell, that's where Jesus was better than you. He never fell. There's a quotation I came across years ago by B.F. Westcott. He said, "Sympathy with the sinner in his trial does not depend on the experience of sin, but on the experience of temptation to sin, which only the sinless can know in its full intensity. He who falls yields before the last strain." Jesus understood temptation at a level that none of us ever have, because he never fell. He always endured the temptation in its fullest intensity. So yes, Jesus is entirely sympathetic with us in our temptations, yet without sin. And that's one of the things that the Bible points out over and over and over again. Here in Hebrews in chapter 7, verse 26, "It was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens." He didn't need a sacrifice for himself. His sacrifice was for others who were stained by sin, who were guilty of sin. In John chapter 8, Jesus once challenged his opponents. He said, "Which of you convicts me of sin?" He said, "I dare you. I know you don't like me. I know you don't believe me, but what sin have I committed?" And that's interesting to me in the Gospels, that the leaders of the Jews and the people who just despised Jesus, they tripped all over themselves trying to get him out of the way. The one thing they could never do was accuse him of sin, because he didn't have any. Jesus simply did not have any sins. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, "He who knew no sin became sin for us." He knew no sin. He never committed sin. And even though he was the Son of God, he was tempted. And even though he was tempted, he never failed. And in that, he has sympathy with his people. He has sympathy with his people. And that leads then to the next exhortation in the text. Because of that, we need to draw near. Remember that Jesus is our high priest, therefore we hold fast our confession of him as our Lord, as our God, as our high priest. Jesus, as our high priest, had sympathy with us, and that should help us with the next application, and that is to draw near to him. So verse 16 of our text, you go back to it, verse 16 of our text, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Second time in the text, let us do this. First, let us hold fast our confession. Second, let us with confidence draw near. The word confidence is an interesting word. It means to speak freely. It means to speak with cheerfulness and courage and absence of fear in speaking. It's a word that's used several times in the book of Acts to denote how the apostles spoke when they were persecuted. They spoke up. They spoke with confidence. People observed the confidence that these apostles had. I think the previous two verses, if you think about the flow of the passage, the previous two verses lay out the essential qualities of the high priest. And again, it puts it in the context of the greater argument here in Hebrews. First of all, he has to be divinely appointed by God. He is God's high priest. He is in the heavenly places. He sits at the right hand of God. He has gone through the heavens. So he is a divinely appointed high priest, but he also has to have a personal knowledge of the human condition. By being lower than the angels, he understood what it's like to be man and to suffer temptation. No earthly priest, no self-appointed priest could claim to be appointed by God, and no angel could understand what it was like to be human. Jesus alone met that qualification. And so because he is our sinless high priest, we have the confidence. We can speak freely to God. Do you believe that? Do you really believe that you can tell God whatever's on your mind? Sometimes our prayers sound like these polite recitations. Kind of like you're talking to a stranger and you don't want to breach any social rules, and so you don't talk about anything intimate or significant. Folks, if there is any place at all where you can be totally yourself, it should be in prayer. And you can tell God what's on your mind. But I'm afraid that sometimes we're afraid we're going to offend God. We're afraid we're going to hurt God's feelings. We're afraid that if I say something too intimate, too personal, too upsetting, somehow God won't like me anymore. If there is any place where we have the right to be ourselves, it is when we pray. We should have this confidence, this cheerfulness, this freedom to speak. And when does he say that should occur? Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. That drawing near to the throne of grace, we approach the throne of grace. And I think here there may be at least a partial reference to the idea of the mercy seat, which is kind of an interesting thing. The mercy seat symbolized the presence of God. And here the throne of grace, we are clearly in the presence of God when we bow before the throne of God. But he wants us to think of it in terms of God's grace and mercy. The mercy seat did symbolize the presence of God, but almost God in his remoteness, because only the high priest was the one who could ever see it. Only the high priest was the one who could approach it, and only that once a year. And in that regard, he was symbolic, if you will, or representative of the Israelites. But no Israelite could ever have the confidence of approaching God at the mercy seat. Here he says, we have confidence to approach the very throne room of God, the throne of grace. And at this throne of grace, he says, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Twice he uses the word grace in this verse. First of all, we receive mercy at the throne of God. And any moment during the day, any moment during our week, whenever we're struggling with anything, we can find grace to help, grace that gives us help in time of need. That is the kind of confidence that we have in this high priest. This little paragraph, this little three-verse paragraph, is at a critical point in the letter. I think he's kind of winding down what he said in chapters 3 and 4 with yet another exhortation, but he's preparing us for this elaborate idea of Jesus as our high priest. And he wants to begin on a positive way by saying, you can talk to God. You can come to God. You can have the help of God because Jesus knows what it's like. Later in chapter 7, we're told in verse 25 that he ever lives to make intercession for us. He is eternally at the right hand of God, acting as our intermediate, acting as one who gives help to us. And in my mind's eye, I can picture Jesus leaning over and speaking to the Father, "Father, consider my servant. He's struggling today. I know what that's like. Be merciful to him. Give him the grace he needs to overcome." That is Jesus as our intercessor. That is Jesus as our sympathetic high priest. And that means that all of this is available to us. Our theme this year has been, we have an anchor. And that anchor is called hope. And we have that hope because of Jesus Christ. It's based on Hebrews 6, 19 and 20. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil where Jesus has entered. This passage talks about that. Not only do we have hope, but we also have help. And that help is ever available. Does Jesus care? Oh, yes, he cares. I know he cares. His heart is touched with my grief. If you know that, will you come to Jesus and find his help? If you know that, Will you openly confess him to others? I know that you made the good confession when you became a Christian, but day by day, do you confess your faith to others? Day by day, do others know that you rely every moment on the Son of God? And day by day, will you live in such a way that people see this confidence that you have in your relationship to God? Do people see you as someone full of hope or someone full of fear? Someone full of joy or someone full of doubt? Someone full of the hope of God or someone who's not even sure if they're saved? You can have this kind of hope, but you can have it only in Jesus Christ. And that's our invitation to you this morning. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, we want to invite you to do that by being baptized into Christ. If you are a Christian, maybe you're struggling with doubt. Maybe you're struggling in your life. If that's the case, we want to help you in whatever way we can while we stand and sing.